Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Caracas, Venezuela for an update on the sudden change from reverence and mourning the death of President Chavez to bare-knuckle politics with the announcement of an election in 30 days that has the anointed Vice President Maduro calling his opponent Capriles a fascist and Capriles taunting Maduro by saying, "The people didn't vote for you, kid." Virginia Lopez, who covers Venezuela for the UK Guardian and Britain Sky TV, joins us to discuss how much the decks are stacked in favour of the Chavistas. Then we'll get an alarming report from an expert on Hungarian politics, Kim Scheppeler, the director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. She did research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary, where today the ruling right-wing government erased all of the Constitutional Court's decisions, removing any checks and balances on a government that is displaying fascist tendencies and certainly tolerating, if not encouraging, extremist attacks on gypsies and homeless people, activities that have an eerie echo of Germany in the 1930s. Then finally, at a time when $85 billion in sequester cuts are dominating the debate, we'll get an accounting of how many trillions America's Fortune 500 companies are hiding in profits stashed offshore to avoid taxes. Matthew Gardner, the Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy and an analyst with Citizens for Tax Justice, joins us to discuss the enormous amounts of profits GE, Apple, Microsoft, IBM, Google, and others hide offshore to avoid paying taxes. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, who is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky Television. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And obviously, you've had a busy couple of weeks, Virginia. And now on Sunday, the opposition leader, who lost by 10 to 11 points in the last election, Capriles, has stepped back into the ring, if you will, to run in this election against the anointed vice president, who has to obviously run for office. Already it's getting a little nasty, isn't it? Capriles is saying to Maduro that the people didn't vote for you, kid, and Maduro is calling Capriles a fascist.
Yes, it's the first time that Capriles is so vocal, and even yesterday before announcing that he would run for office, because there had been doubt until the very last minute, he accused Maduro of utilizing Chavez's death politically, and even of lying as to how and when President Chavez had really died or passed away. So yes, it's and of course Maduro reacted violently against these allegations and even threatened to legally sue Capriles for having offended the memory of, you know, Comandante. So yes, it promises to be a rather colorful next 30 days running up to the election.
So do you think Capriles has a chance here? I mean, with all the sympathy for Chavez, which obviously will benefit his hand-picked successor, Maduro, it's hard to see Capriles having much of a chance. And I take it he felt that he didn't have any choice. He had to run. In other words, he's lost the last election, and he'll be a two-time loser, won't he?
Yes, it was a bit of a dilemma from what he said yesterday in this announcement that he would run. It's incredibly unfair conditions for the election. Even Jennifer McCoy of the Carter Center, who in the past had been rather supportive of the Venezuelan electoral system, came out saying that even though mechanically, electorally, you know, the elections in Venezuela seem to be fair, the conditions of the race certainly weren't. A 30-day, campaign period doesn't benefit anybody but the government's candidate. And certainly the sympathy vote will also benefit Maduro, you know, incredibly. There's even talk about combining this presidential election with a referendum to consult the people whether they can, whether Chavez's body can be buried at the National Pantheon within the next 30 days or so. But because there's an article that states that 25 years must pass before somebody moves to the national pantheon. By framing this election with these two questions, I think the idea is to get people who would have abstained from voting for Maduro but not for Chavez to go out and show their support of Chavez.
So what is going on over the actual burial? Because my understanding is that Chavez himself expressed a desire to be buried in the plains where he grew up in the country, and that at one point or other he had mentioned the idea of bodies on display in perpetuity, like Lenin, Mao, and Ho Chi Minh, and thought that was macabre. So is there any understanding that that putting him on display for eternity in this crystal urn in Caracas is not necessarily Chavez's wishes? What's being reported down there about that?
Not much. I mean, I think still there people are flocking to see him, and, you know, their voices in this regard haven't necessarily been felt. Except to say, actually, that yes, that they want him to be resting alongside Simón Bolívar in the pantheon, because he, like Simón Bolívar, and this was actually something I was told several times in the street, Chávez, like Simón Bolívar, was a liberator in that he had, you know, liberated Venezuelans from the dominion of, I don't know, the empire. But you're right, Chávez was vehement on several occasions in televised addresses that he wanted to be buried very simply in the flatlands, which is sort of like the Argentinian Pampas, and with that same sort of identity for llaneros that the gauchos have for the Pampas. So yeah, it's a bit sad to see that his will isn't being respected. And yes, and actually he even went to the extremes of expelling that museum exhibit called Bodies. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yes, I am. I saw it here in Los Angeles.
All right. Well, when it came to Venezuela, it only lasted about 2 or 3 days before Chavez expelled the whole exhibit from the country, banning it and saying that this was, in effect, a rather macabre display, and that, you know, that it was very strange and he didn't understand how that could be done. So again, yes, it's in, you know, it's obvious that it's in clear violation of what he wanted to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is in Caracas, Venezuela. She covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Britain's Sky TV. Now, when Capriles accused Vice President Maduro of lying to the public about Hugo Chavez's cancer surgery and his condition of his health, I mean, we've spoken a lot over the last several months on that very issue. And the point that you keep making is that, as a journalist, it's completely shrouded in secrecy. So it shouldn't be a very controversial statement to say that the government has lied.
No, of course not. I mean, I thought it was echoing a lot of the sentiment that people had, but, you know, again, we're on a campaign, so I think this Maduro is certainly using this as a political tool, and it's become an issue of seeing who shows more bravado, you know.
So you were obviously covering the funeral and the wake, etc. It seems that the grief that at least the followers of Chavez, and that's certainly the majority of the country, given that he won by 11% in his last election, was quite powerful. So could you describe some of what you saw?
Yes, it was a really interesting contrast of having totally deserted streets and just this sort of eerie silence. And then, you know, walking or driving to the area where Chavez's body was being held for the wake, and just seeing just basically millions of people queuing up for what had been 10, 12 hours to pay their last respects to Chavez. And then once you were in, it was literally like a 5 second period that you had to pay your respects. A lot of people once inside were, you know, crying in despair. And I'm talking, you know, men and women alike, or, you know, they were sort of saluting Chavez with, you know, with a military salute or with a sort of closed fist of, you know, revolutionary salute. But just really, like you said, just a deep sorrow and a collective sorrow at that. So just really powerful. But also a deep sense of respect is the sense I got. You know, it wasn't, I think everybody understood that Chavez had been, you know, larger than life figure and a leader and at the head of the country for 14 years. And even if you didn't like him, you stood in solidarity of the pain that so many, you know, fellow citizens were experiencing.
So were you able to see any of the international visitors that came, the heads of states? Of course, most have been greeted with a lot of skepticism here in the press in the United States. Obviously, Europe's last dictator, the Belarusian dictator Lukashenko, is not particularly highly regarded, and President Ahmadinejad of Iran. There was, of course, a couple of U.S. congresspeople, both of whom I believe are friends of Chavez, Congressman Meeks and former Congressman Delahunt, who I think is also a friend of Maduro's as well. But obviously that's not the kind of level of representation that other countries sent, particularly the Iranian president, etc.
Yeah, well, the lineup was, you know, was quite indicative of I thought, you know, a move in foreign policy or keeping the status quo over the Chavez years. It was on the front row and doing the first guard of honor were Raul Castro, Ahmadinejad, Lukashenko, and it was other leaders like Santos from neighboring Colombia only came in for the second guard of honor, and he was seated like three rows to the, you know, in the back. So again, you know, definitely the spotlight was taken by Chavez's more radical allies. Ahmadinejad had not only got, you know, like a 1 minute long round of applause, he also kissed the coffin. It was a very emotional display of, you know, his solidarity towards his fellow, you know, president. The American delegation, like you said, it was made up of Congressman Jesse Jackson, also officiated a brief mass and spoke of conciliation and you know, and sort of respect for this leader. And I think he tried to highlight, you know, the more sort of conciliatory aspects of Chavez's personality. It was quite interesting, though. Maduro went from being very radical at one point in his speech that day and saying, you know, that the enemies wouldn't return. That's a sort of the famous phrase of the Chavez years, no volverán, no? And then saying that this was also, you know, almost immediately afterwards saying that this was a time of forgiveness, that Chavez's death should serve to build bridges, and talked about specifically the American people and said, you know, that they should, you know, make moves towards, like I said, forgiveness. Of course, one mustn't forget that the U.S. is still one of Venezuela's, if not actually Venezuela's most important trading partner. So, you know, I mean, for all the rhetoric, business must go on.
Well, Virginia Lopez, prior to Chavez's death, of course, Vice President Maduro accused the United States of poisoning, or at least not just, he didn't name the United States, but talked about reactionary powers and their agents within Venezuela itself, I guess referring to the Capriles and the opposition. And I believe that he also said that was a belief that was expressed by Chavez himself, that he was somehow infected with cancer by perhaps the CIA or agents of the CIA in Venezuela. So what exactly were they saying? Can you forgive them because of the emotion of this situation? But I'd like to get some clarity on that.
Yeah, well, it was two separate incidents. And I can give you as much clarity as I myself have because it's so very confusing. But yes, certainly right before announcing Chavez's death, Maduro came on national TV and said, you know, again, repeated what Chavez had said in the past, that he, like other leaders, had been given cancer, basically. He also said, this is Maduro, that they had proof and that in due time, you know, they would open an investigation to prove this claim, but that they already were working on serious tips that hinted that this was the case, not that Chavez had been inoculated with cancer. During that same address to the nation, he also expelled two functionaries at the embassy and accused them of plotting and, you know, engaging in destabilizing projects. I think that was his
right. And the U.S. just responded today by expelling two Venezuelan diplomats.
Yeah. So, like I said, there's talk of respect, and oil keeps flowing to the U.S. But there'll still be a lot of this saber rattling, I think.
Right. But you're saying that at the funeral itself, there was different emotions expressed. There was conciliation, even towards the United States?
To the people, to the citizens of the United States. You know, there was a lot of, you know, we love you, we've showed solidarity. And then these previous to only talking about the people, he said on several occasions, this is a time of forgiveness. We must, you know, forgive past affronts. And then in this, he said, we've had relationships with several, people from the U.S. government. In fact, there are two of our friends here, and talked about the congressman that had attended. And then Jesse Jackson came and, like I said, you know, offered a service. And Maduro and Reverend Jackson were seen often together. They then asked Reverend Jackson, somebody in the press here asked Reverend Jackson if he had been an envoy of the U.S. government, and he said that he hadn't, that it had actually been his own idea to come.
So what's your sense then, Virginia Lopez, of it sounds like there hasn't been really a kind of decent interval here to mourn Chavez before the politics take over because of the 30-day election window, which you mentioned earlier that the Carter Center feels it's not entirely fair to the opposition. But is that what's happening now, that it's really now the gloves are off and it's already pretty nasty, isn't it, with Capriles talking about Maduro, saying, you know, you're referring to him as people didn't vote for you, kid. And then, of course, Maduro referring to him as a fascist. I mean, a lot of people... go ahead.
Yes, I agree. It's a bit of what happened, and Capriles mentioned this, but again, you know, we're on a campaign already, so it's all bound to be political. They had declared 7 days of national mourning, and during those 7 days of national mourning, when, you know, all businesses were supposed to be closed, the Supreme Court passed a ruling allowing a president in charge, Maduro, to also run for office. Capriles had an issue with this and called this ruling fraudulent. And then, of course, there was a bit of comments, you know, flying backwards and, you know, from one camp to the other as to whether this was really fraudulent or if it wasn't, and clarifications. But again, you know, it almost seemed that it was a bit of a waste of time, because so many of the institutions here are dominated by Chavez's supporters that clearly, you know, they're going to be used to further the political, the political aims of the government party.
So you're talking also, how much more powerful is government media than private media in terms of political messaging?
Yes, well, it's, you know, there's this news circulating today. I've yet to confirm it. They're supposed to have a proper announcement about Globovision having sold some of its shares to people who are from the Chavista camp. And Globovision was one of the few, actually, Globovision is the only opposition outlet of news that is left. So just to give you an indication of how this would affect politics in Venezuela, Capriles' announcement was only broadcast by Globovision yesterday. It was the only way that people had of seeing Capriles talk about, you know, his plans to run for president. If Globovision is no longer in the hands of the opposition, or has now an editorial line that they have to abide by, chances are that the opposition will really be occupying less and less media space than they already are.
So already Chavistas have the state television, and you're suggesting that the one opposition network is likely to be compromised or silenced?
If indeed it's true that it was bought by a group of Chavez supporters, I would think that that's what's going to happen. I would assume that their editorial line will veer according to the interests of the owners.
Well, that's certainly news. A lot of defenders of Chavez here in the United States have been saying how much the right-wing opposition press has dominated the debate. And, of course, it's pretty clear that the opposite has been true and is even more so now if they close down the opposition television.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, Chavez always spoke of gaining hegemonic control. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily surprise me that little by little they will, follow their plan. This has all been very sort of strategically planned, I get the sense. It's a mistake to think that Chavez was an eccentric who didn't know what he was doing. I think he was an incredibly clever strategist.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Caracas.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Britain's Sky TV. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting an alarming report about how fascism is blossoming in the middle of Europe.